Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Did you know that Off Camera was also a television show? Well, if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you know that we are a podcast, a magazine, and a television show. But what you may not know is you can watch full episodes in glorious black and white on our own website, offcamera.com. And now we've made that even easier by creating a monthly subscription so you can watch all the Off Camera you want. For only $4.99, you can subscribe to Off Camera and binge watch until the cows come home. And not only that, but new episodes pop up every week, so you can always stay up to date with the show. If you haven't yet checked it out, it's a whole different way to experience Off Camera. As you're listening to these stories, you can watch these thoughts form on these artists' faces, and it feels like you're right there in the room during the conversation. So check that out. It's a great option to the podcast, and it's also a great way to support the show. So check that out at offcamera.com. Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actress Betty Gilpin. Before she was body slamming opponents as her wrestling alter ego Liberty Bell on Netflix's Glow, Betty Gilpin was coming to terms with her own self-perception. The beta personality who sat with the bugs and observed human behavior as a kid wasn't matching with what the industry saw on the outside. They noticed her beauty and her body, but failed to notice her, quote, monster soup, that creative messiness that lives inside of us. She pulls no punches about her own career, describing many of the parts she was getting as one-dimensional female stereotypes, or in her words, Voldemort drag bimbo Barbies. All Betty wanted was a role that reflected her ultra-creative insides, which makes sense when you consider that both of her parents were theater actors, and she spent her childhood in the playhouses of New York City. She says, "I grew up with the sense that there's a magic underbelly to the world, a tribe of these special clown people who gossip while putting on false eyelashes and handing out Werther's candies while you listen to the play over the intercom. That magic she experienced as a kid is something she is trying desperately to hold on to, and not to take for granted. As somebody who has struggled with insecurity, Betty warns, you don't want all the doors to creativity to close because you're so worried about being judged." After 5 arduous auditions for Glow, the role of a lifetime was finally hers and represented a sea change for Betty. She's valued for her insides, those weird creative parts that want to roam free, and her body is seen as an example of female empowerment, not as a sex symbol custom made for the male gaze. She says, "I'm in a race to get to a place where I love myself. So when the things that the patriarchy has told me are valuable about myself start to leave and wrinkle beautifully, I can say, oh, I don't think about that anymore." Betty joins Off Camera to discuss why her brain resembles a Pixar movie, what monster soup is and why it's so important to her, the emotional and physical breakdown that changed her life, and what it really feels like to be an actress. Like, really, honestly, what it feels like. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Betty.
Hi, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. I am such a big fan of Glow.
Thank you.
I'm just excited to get inside your head because all that I've read about you and sort of your story is fascinating to me. And then I read this Lenny letter that you wrote. It made me think that if you don't write a book, it will be a sad thing because I felt like the essay was so enlightening on the process of being an actress, being an artist, that I wanted to ask you a million things about it.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. I mean, you know, this year, the past 2 years being in Glow and promoting Glow when we're not doing Glow, it really made me face certain things about myself for the first time in a sort of public way. I've always felt like kind of a beta personality in a lot of ways. And so much of being an actress, you have to use all this alpha energy when you're busy or you're promoting stuff or you're self-promoting. It felt like I was having to like Frankenstein parts of my personality to assemble an organized woman with a briefcase who believed in herself.
Right. You describe your head as a room full of women and they take the wheel at different times.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't help think a little bit of the movie Inside Out because
yes,
I've watched it 100 times with my
middle school age children.
I've watched it alone as an adult.
Well, it's a fantastic movie.
Yeah.
But you describe these characters and you've given them names and personalities. Mm-hmm. And one of the characters that struck me as very relatable to my own struggles is Ingrid St. Rash, who seems to be your harshest self-critic who, as you said, convinces you that you're a lesion on society.
Yes, yeah.
I think the thing that was so relatable to me was that you describe thinking everyone else has a Cheryl Manila. And Cheryl Manila is supposed to be the one, like you said, who has it together and has self-esteem and is organized and can put
Type
things
a.
into context.
Yep.
Right. And you sort of say in the essay that other people have a Cheryl and you don't, and you're missing that key part.
Yes.
But I think that's a really relatable thing.
Yeah, I'm surprised it's relatable because I feel like when you feel that way, you feel like you're the only person who is missing that part of your personality. And I've thought about it so much just like doing press for, you know, there's so many, like we travel and we have to be organized and have to have our logistics in order. And someday they're going to figure out that not only am I not an organized woman with a briefcase, but I'm like a sad witch in the woods with like toothpaste everywhere.
Do witches use toothpaste?
That's a great question. Maybe they just eat it. But, you know, I also, it's hard for me to remember that, you know, those are also parts of me that I like. Even though Ingrid St. Rash is very hard on herself and the insecure and self-loathing parts of me, you know, a lot of the darker, more questioning parts of me also are parts that I really value creatively. And so I don't want to totally shut those things down. I think maybe it's a part of every person's creative process where you realize like, oh, if I'm like, I'll never have to, like, water the Emily Dickinson, Courtney Love side of myself. Like, that's always going to be there. Like, we may as well take vitamins and, like, try to be nice to ourselves. Because I'm never going to morph into, like, you know, goop.
Right,
it's
right.
never going to happen. But I don't know. It's a hard balance to find, like, what comes from shame and stuff that one should work past and leave behind, and what comes from the side of me that I just like and is like a dark window into the world creatively.
You know, first off, you've chosen a profession that may not be the obvious choice for someone that's a beta personality or someone that suffers from low self-esteem or has a harsh self-critic.
Right. I mean, I kind of feel like there are two kinds of people who become actors. There's the kid who was in the center of the playground being the best, most inherently themselves version of themselves and, you know, so comfortable and loud and confident. And then there was the kid on the side of the playground, like with the bugs, taking notes on human behavior. And then like one day, like presenting their notes. Like, I feel like I definitely was the latter kind of kid, kind of like the sidekick who was, like, saying things out of the corner of their mouths, being like, this is what I observed today. And then the jock overhearing it and being like, this is what I observed, like, saying it louder.
Right.
And getting the laugh. And I kind of feel like a lot of being an actress especially is, like, even if you're the latter kind of kid, you have to pretend you're the former. Like, when I'm working, I do feel like you can, like, swim in the kind of beta-ness of it and be creative and dark. And then in outside of working, it's like, what's your morning routine? And making duck lips and stuff and all this stuff where inside my everything in me is like, oh, my God. But you have to sort of pretend to be the other thing.
Right. And your outsides are sort of that other thing for so many people.
Right. Yes. For this second. That's what's scary is that I feel like for this island of time in my hopefully long life, you know, this is the best it's going to be. And then it's all going to fall down because it's all real. But I want to keep acting and keep doing things. So I can't listen to the business when it tells me, like, the things we want to hear and see from you are the things that are going to expire. So I have to, I feel like it's my job to sort of Trojan horse it into people's brains, like, hey, maybe I got this job because my tits are in my chin and I've got like Kardashian war paint and like a tailored outfit within an inch of my life. And now I'm like, and here are the three weird ideas that I planned alone in my room. Like, thanks for inviting me for this stuff, but I'm also weird. And like, when my face falls and my tits are in my shoes, like, can you keep hiring me for the weird part? Because I want to do this until I'm 85.
Right.
But I don't know. I feel like things are changing slowly, but it's tough. Men get to be, you know, sexy and complicated for a way longer time.
You know, it's funny. I picked up on something you said about the kid on the playground. I wondered where the two dovetailed, like your love of pretending and acting and imagination.
Yeah.
And the idea that you were less than that you felt like you had to fake it or apologize or like you didn't have any confidence. How did those two cross? And at what age did it get complicated?
Yeah. You know, I grew up, both my parents are actors.
Right.
And did mostly theater when I was growing up. So I grew up going to as many rehearsals as they would let me go to and sitting in the stage manager's booth and watching, you know, Hay Fever and Arsenic and Old Lace like 100 times. And just growing up with the sense that there's a magic underbelly to the whole world. And, like, there are really special clown people to be found in this world and, like, a tribe of people, you know, that gossip while putting on false eyelashes and like give you Werther's candies while you listen to like the intercom of the play happening on stage. I was like, this is the most...
It was magic.
Magic. And I think sadly for a lot of girls, part of the growing up process is like just shame creeping into your brain at a certain point and the realization that like, oh, maybe I'm gross. Oh, maybe no one wants me around.
Is there an example of that you remember?
I'll definitely like look at pictures of myself at an age where I remember in that moment being like, oof, this is my ugliest year. Or this is like the year that I felt the loneliest. And I'll look and be like, oh, what a pretty little girl. Like, what a... And at the moment, I was like, I'm a troll. But not just aesthetically. Like, I don't know. I don't know where it was learned. But also, depression was a big part of my life. But that also, you know, I learned that there was magic to be had from my parents in theater. But then in college, I was like, oh, the things that are darker, like shame and depression, they can also, they don't have to be like steel doors that come down. They can be like something you can swim in and ask questions in and use that in your work, to be insanely pretentious about it. But like that it's not just all about like, let's put on funny hats and tap dance around because life is hard. So let's like put a trapdoor on top of that and be like, da, 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 da. Like, let's also like take the trapdoor off and be like, and put that on stage too. Like, that's valuable too. And maybe there's a marriage to be had of like, Miss Hannigan and Sylvia Plath. Like, maybe they can hold hands and say stuff together. But, you know, no one woke me up in the middle of the night and forced me to be an actor. I hate it hearing, like, I hate having my picture taken.
Right, of course.
It's like, well, then maybe you should work in a button factory. So I, you know, it's some of it's really fun. And some of it, you know, I'm sure when I'm begging to play Elle Fanning's grandmother on a CBS multicam, I'll be like, FedEx man, look at this picture they once took of me. I was very relevant. And so it's kind of like, what tolls are you willing to pay to get to do that stuff?
So in a sense, I feel like a lot of kids who grow up with the dream of acting, their role model is, you know, a Meryl Streep or a Julia Roberts or a whoever.
Right.
Right? They don't get to see what the actual business is up close. And I was just curious, growing up with two at working actors, how that sort of set the die for you.
Well, I guess something that I realized that I just totally took for granted was that you know, when you're an actor, there's just so much vulnerability involved, whether you're working or not. When you're not working, it's the rejection on a scale where you can really go down a mental rabbit hole of, it's just very sad and scary and unstable and knowing, you know, struggling with that stuff now and for the past 12 years of me working as an actor, it gives me perspective on what my parents must have struggled with. But then also when they're working, when an actor is working, ideally you're asking yourself the big questions about life and putting yourself in, you know, a murderer's shoes or an adulterer's shoes or a warrior's shoes or a princess's shoes, you know, trying to look at life from all these different angles that, like, maybe other people's parents didn't think that way. And what a valuable gift that that was for me as, like, a playmate for my parents, or like when I was going to them with a problem, that they had spent their professional lives thinking in every way possible. And to me, I really value that.
Right. Were they excited about you becoming an actress?
No.
They were not.
Not at
so
all.
What was that?
I mean, they're very supportive and they were very excited, but the rule was I had to go to a college that it wasn't a conservatory where I had to study Spanish and math
right.
and all that stuff and, like, hopefully fall in love with that stuff. But I could major in theater, and then I had to graduate before I worked professionally, which I kind of did.
What message does that send you that here are two people that are in that very business and they're telling you – they're trying to guide you away from
yeah.
it?
Yeah. Well, I understood. I mean, when I was little, I was pissed that they wouldn't let me be like a child star. But by the time I was in high school, I was grateful for it. I wanted to fall in love with it on my own terms
right.
and want it really badly for myself instead of just trying to recreate the magic I'd seen my parents partake in. I wanted to train. It was important to me, you know, I wanted to study it. And then when I graduated college and I was ready to audition for all these character parts and, like, cross my eyes and make the craziest faces possible, they're like, squinting would be good, but no faces.
So what do you mean squinting?
Like this kind of, like, hey, you're back. So brave. I'll be in the kitchen. Great job out there. Thank you. And, like, I would audition for those parts being like, ah, you're back. Great job out there. And they'd be like, oh, okay. Let's take it way down.
So you were raised by character actors.
Yeah.
And then you were seen as this sort of the woman who gets out of the way for the
right, yes, yeah.
Whatever the story.
Evil Barbie at the beginning or Bimbo Barbie. Like,
right.
The evil or Bimbo were kind of the two. You know, like either corporate being like, I won't stand for it, or, you know, kind of like, wait, you like the girl with the ukulele, but what about me? It was sort of like my tits were too big and my voice was too low to be the Pixie Dream girl. So they were like, you're 45 and you run a company in space.
No, but it's interesting because I think that what you're talking about is up until very, very recently,
yeah,
just considered that's the deal, right? No
yeah.
one looked too far into the stereotypes.
Right, no.
It reveals the struggle that a woman would have to find a story that makes you excited at all to do your job.
Yes, yeah. And it's like an impossible task. I mean, if you look back at like the movies like or like Oscar-winning performances, men versus women, my theory, which may be controversial, is that women just have to do so much more. Like, have your obliques showing while you're sobbing, but don't show the laugh lines. But also, like, you know, making a million choices in a scene, kind of being like, what's going on in there? And the men get to have the doors closed, all the questions answered, and their performance is like, no. And that's, and it's like, Oscar. And the woman's like, monologue, like, why? I mean, it's just, it's so crazy. It's so crazy.
Well, in the Lenny letter, you say I was playing the standard Voldemort drag Barbie,
uh-huh.
and it made me realize, like, gosh, if you've done it enough to actually have a name for it.
Right, yeah.
How do you square that with the kid who wanted to act and come in with her theories about bugs? And,
right.
And how do you feel like you're doing something that's that was your dream initially?
Well, I also had a very realistic idea of what my future would be very early on in terms of, like, theater versus film and TV and what I could accomplish. Kind of the top of my dream was, like, I'll get to ask the big questions and be my ugliest, monstriest, clowniest self in theater, and then whatever TV and film that I could get, I would do anything to just have health insurance and pay my rent. I mean, I really tried so hard to get on the most terrible programs that, like, I mean, I, like, sobbed when I didn't get, like, you know, Jargon Thumbelina number 4 in CSI Prague. Like, I like, sobbed on Wilshire Boulevard being like, it's over. Because to me, you know, especially raised in theater, it felt like, you know, 0.00001 of the population of actors got to actually feed their souls on screen. Like, that just never even entered my dreams.
Right.
So now it just feels like there's, like, this lockbox that I'm opening now of, like, we've had this other dream that we never thought would come true that's sort of happening. Sort of like, what do I do? I never even dreamed this far, ever.
Hey folks, Sam Jones here to talk about your teeth. The truth is, most of us are brushing our teeth wrong, not for long enough, and most of us forget to change our brush on time. That's because most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing, but not Quip. So what makes Quip so different? For starters, Quip is an electric toothbrush that's a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes, while still packing just the right amount of vibrations to help clean your teeth. Quip's built-in timer helps you clean for the dentist recommended 2 minutes with guiding pulses that remind you when to switch sides. But here's where Quip is really unique. Quip's subscription plans are for your health, not just convenience. They deliver new brush heads on a dentist recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel wherever you take your teeth. And I'll have you know, I took my teeth to Idaho a few weeks ago, and I took my Quip toothbrush with me. And it's all true. It sticks to the mirror, and it becomes a cover. It's pretty neat. And finally, everybody loves Quip. They were just on Oprah's O list and named one of Time's best inventions. And Quip is the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. Plus, they're backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists, and hundreds of thousands of happy brushers use Quip every day, myself included. So here's the deal. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/offcamera right now, you'll get your first free refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. So I'm going to call out to all the off-camera listeners to try Quip out. I use it every day. I'm assuming that you all have very nice teeth and you want to keep them that way. So give it a shot. And know that when you get a Quip toothbrush and try it out, you're not only taking care of your mouth, but you're also supporting Off Camera. So go to getquip.com/offcamera. And remember, you get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. So it's spelled getquip.com/offcamera. So try it out and send me an email. Tell me what you think. And now, if everyone has brushed their teeth and has their PJs on, let's get back to the show.
What happened when you made the shift from mostly theater to getting enough roles on television?
Yeah.
What happened self-esteem-wise?
Like, I could not watch things I was in because I would just rip myself apart.
Was that Ingrid St. Rash watching?
For sure, Ingrid St. Rash. But also, like, I realized it was also, it's also narcissism in a way. Like, I remember saying to my husband, then boyfriend, we were on the subway once, and I was like, those two people are making fun of me. Long ago. I was like, I can tell they're like laughing at me and laughing at my pants or something. And he was like, no one's looking at you. Like, they're talking about something else. Like, it's the solipsism of my self-loathing that's like, even they are thinking about me and the ways. And it's like, no, that's, no one cares. And I realized that about a lot of things that I was so hard on myself about. It's like, no one cares. Like, my first Law and Order episode, my husband was like, let's have people over and watch it. And I was like, yeah, that's a great idea. We had 10 of our closest friends over, and like, the opening shot, I was like, kush! I was like, what a terrible, I was like, I'm just going to run and pee. And then like sat on the bathroom, like the tub, lip of the tub, and was just like, no one told me about my ears and the sound of my voice and the way that I blink. No one told me about that. Just, I mean, it's just so stupid. And also, the thing that worries me about all of this stuff is like, I'm just so scared that like all these doors will come down. Like, nope, then you're cut off from creativity, you're cut off from the monster soup, then none of that stuff is invited anymore because people are watching or because you're being judged. You know, you sort of have to, in order to like act in a scene, you have to pretend that this mic isn't there, those lights aren't there, they're not there.
Sure.
It's like you're coaxing a ghost into the room who like doesn't like any of this stuff, and you have to like pretend that it doesn't exist. And I don't know, I think that you have to like protect that part of yourself. So I don't know. It used to be that watching myself, it would ensure that the ghost wouldn't come into the room. Like, that the magic stuff wouldn't happen because I was viewing myself from the outside.
Okay, so in the Lenny letter, this big event happens, mm-hmm. Which seemed to me, reading between the lines, like a full-on breakdown where your body rebelled against you.
Yeah, I think that is what was happening, was that there was a part of myself that was like, don't forget me. I need to come with you to wherever you're going because you're killing me. And like, if you're not feeding that part, then that part is going to like someday take you by the collar and be like, you gotta fucking listen to me because you're killing me. By only doing this and like scooping up this stuff, it's like, yeah, you can't take it for granted. You have to put your phone down and breathe and read a book.
So tell me about what happened with
the muscle spasm,
yeah. Right? Yeah.
I was just having a crazy, crazy time I was shooting Masters of Sex, and I had just gotten married, and I was also wrestling training, so for GLOW and then shooting GLOW the next week, and was just like on no sleep, just running myself totally ragged. There was literally no time, like wolfing down lunch while I was like driving to the next thing, then body slamming someone, then going back on set and, you know, being Voldemort drag Barbie. And then one day this started to happen, and just like that. And I was like, okay, that's super weird. And then it turned into, I mean, it was like that, like, and like just like, or it would go like that and then like that, or it would go up this arm and go like that. And I feel like I was raised to believe, or not, like, if you have cancer, you're probably faking it. Like, we weren't a hypochondriac family at all. Like, I feel like actresses get a bad name because they're like, I have, when I eat almonds, my ankles swell and I can't see the color purple because I'll pass out. It's like, oh, that's not real. So, but this was real. Like, I couldn't stop it. It was like claw hands shaking, just the craziest. It was so fucking crazy. And it lasted for 6 days.
Oh my God. So even when you lay down to sleep?
Yeah. Yep. I slept like on my stomach with my arms pinned like that, and to just keep them from, and then they would kind of, I would wake up because my arm would fly out and like look at me like, it was crazy.
Hey, you didn't think maybe I should go see a doctor?
Why would you go to...
But that's fascinating, because it seems like it was this accumulation of self-awareness that needed to happen.
Mm-hmm. It was my body, basically told me, like, not only are you in the room, you're now, you thought you were the Like you attracted unwanted attention in a room when you were just sitting in a chair? Here you go. Here's some unwanted attention. Now you look like a Yeti on a, like, those, like, vibrating cellulite machines from the 1950s.
That's terrible.
Yeah. But it kind of felt like that, where it just put everything in perspective of, like, this is actually what needs to be addressed right now.
Right.
And I don't know.
It's Tell like, me about the witch.
The witch that I went to?
Yeah.
Well, I'd gone to all these very expensive doctors who were like, $500 copay. Yeah, I don't know what's going on with you. I was like, okay, thank you so much. And I will say LA was the best place in the world that I could have chosen to have a strange health crisis, because there's a healer on every corner. And it's like, if you paint a brick wall white, I will give you $1,000. Like, if you speak to me self-righteously in front of a white brick wall, I'm like, you must know what you're talking about. But yeah, so I was kind of at the end of my rope in terms of like yelping people who could figure out what was going on with me. And I found this woman who is a cranial sacral masseuse, was what she purported to be. And it was just this lady who like massaged people out of her apartment and was the first person who was like, I know exactly what's happening to you. Like, you just, let's talk it through, and kind of talked to that darkest, weirdest, college theater-iest part of me and was like, let's get super weird and abstract about it and like talk to your other selves.
Really?
Yeah. And that's what calmed me down. And I mean, maybe it was placebo, but I don't think so. I really think that there was someone, a part of me in me that was like, you're not listening to me. You're spending so much time running, and I need you to stop and turn around and look at me, because I'm like, you're doing all this stuff on behalf of your true self to try and like set up your life in a way that, you know, we can access this, but like, what you're actually doing the opposite. You're actually hurting yourself. And yeah, I felt like I was like a stage mom who was like, this is good for you. We're going to get you, you know, you're going to thank me. And then like, I do all this stuff and I turn around and my daughter's crying. Like,
right.
Yeah.
No, I understand that.
Right. Right.
But that's fascinating, because I feel like this thing you described was this cathartic moment that made you realize that you don't have to be the sum total of what everyone expects you to be, or when someone says you have to be squinty.
Right.
And small, your fear is, if I don't do that, I won't get my health insurance, and I won't take care of the part that wants to be an artist.
Yeah, I think that I realized I didn't need... I didn't need to be a different personality or a different person to have self-worth. Like, there's a difference between self-confidence and self-worth.
Well, in the Lenny letter, you talked about when you wanted something badly, when you wanted a part, you would often sabotage the audition. So what do you think made you not sabotage the GLOW audition?
I mean, it wasn't like an audition where I was like, that was way different than any audition I've ever had. I auditioned for like 5 times, I think. And it was leading up to my wedding. My last audition was on a Wednesday, and I got married on that Saturday.
Oh, wow.
So my brain was kind of there with my husband, thankfully, and not, but he was like, please get this job. Don't be walking down the aisle sobbing. But, you know, I'd had a lot of, it had been between me and another person for a lot of stuff, and it had gone the other way a lot. For stuff that I at the time was like, this is it. This is the job.
So you sort of had an adversary that on several different jobs.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, yeah. Girls, Veep, Orange is the New Black. Like, it wasn't down to me and that person, but, like, I really wanted those jobs and, like, got called back for those jobs. And was like, when I read them, I was like, this is it. This is me. This is the role I'm supposed to play. And then when it doesn't happen, you know, you're kind of like, oh, that kind of felt like the movie montage was headed towards that happening. So I think I had a kind of realistic sense, like, I really thought it just wasn't going to happen. So I was like, eh, fuck it.
You mean in a global sense it wasn't going to happen? Like, when those parts came along?
You know, I just think, like, after 10 years of auditioning, I was like, oh, it just doesn't, even when it feels like you're seeing yourself on the page, or like, oh, my God, they wrote a self-loathing Marilyn, or they wrote a Barbie clown. I've never seen a Barbie clown. I'm the Barbie clown. This is it. So when those came up, I was like, oh. Like, it usually either was like in a play where they taped my boobs down and I played like on stage, I could play someone who like didn't look like me or whatever and be, you know, a complicated layered character. And then, or it would be like I'd be in this outfit, but, you know, not have the monster soup stuff. But so when these jobs came along, these auditions or scripts that I felt like, oof, I could be, look like myself and use that like swimming in Black Ocean and the Miss Hannigan stuff all in one thing. I was like, oh, like those were especially heartbreaking too. You know, you can feel like, being an actor can feel like you're kind of like an Ellis Island for clowns and ghosts to walk through. Like you're auditioning for all these things and letting characters live in you for a second, and then you have to let them go. And this part, I was like, I don't want to let her in because... Ugh, I'm going to cry, because I didn't want to ever let her go. I was like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. I've had this so many times where I let in this person and like I feel whatever. It sounds pretentious.
No, but it
I feel
doesn't. Like it, a, I'm with you.
Like alchemy magic happened. Like that, like I saw when I was a kid. Not saying I was good, but just like that, like, things clicked in my soul and it felt like tingly soul circus. And it's painful when it doesn't happen because you've opened the door and then you have to say goodbye. And it was, you know, but I was like, then what's the point of being alive if I'm not going to try? Or, you know, so many people don't have that door open. And even though it's painful, it's also very joyful to have it open. So, like, maybe I'll just be her for 5 auditions and then I'll say goodbye to her. So I kind of treated it like I had the part for 5 auditions, not like, hey, I'm trying to be this person. It's like, well, I'm just going to be her for 5 auditions and then let her go. And I really let her go. Like, at the last one, I was like, well, that was the last time. Because... I don't know. Not that I – that wasn't the self-loathing part. Like, oh, I know I'm not going to get it. It was like I just – you know, the odds of it actually happening are crazy, crazy. And the
kid, to find a script with that much layer and depth.
Yeah.
What I hear you saying is that when you really love something and mm-hmm. you hardly ever get to do it to your full potential.
Right.
And something comes along and teases you. Mm-hmm. You almost got to that cynical part of, well, I just don't even want it if I don't want to feel that heartbreak again.
Right, yeah.
And what a hard place for an artist to be in,
yeah.
You know?
I feel like maybe all artists feel this way, where artists, where, like, there's a moat of self-loathing, shame, it'll never happen for me, I'm the worst, da, 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 da. And then in the middle of that moat, there's, like, a person who's a centimeter tall who's, like, I think if someone gave me the chance, I think I could be special. I think. I'm not, I actually, no, I know I could. But like surrounded by a million people being like, you're the worst thing that ever happened ever.
I like that yours is a musical.
For <It's> sure. yeah. It's easier to be like, well, you know, I was just never given the chance. It's another thing when that person is given the chance. It's like, okay,
when
here you
see
go. Here's
that,
your chance.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, what if the person's wrong and I'm not special at all and I'm given the chance. You're like, here it is. And the people are like, no. But I was like, then just give yourself the chance this once. Like, shut down the moat of people, of self-loathing, and just let that centimeter tall person drive for 1 second.
You know, what's funny is that some crossover is happening in my brain between the story you're telling me and what I imagine your character on GLOW, Debbie, mm-hmm. what her backstory is.
Yes.
In terms, not her backstory so much, but in terms of her mental state.
Yeah.
And I wonder if the showrunners, Liz and Carly, if yeah. they sort of knew enough about you mm-hmm. that was sort of written into the mix of who this person
totally.
Was.
Totally. They kind of knew that inside I am, you know, like the pigeon lady from Home Alone 2. so they knew that, and they definitely write for that, for sure. And it's such a gift. But they definitely, you know, they knew, they first got to really know me in Nurse Jackie when the character that I played on that show was definitely supposed to be, was on paper, you know, it was season 5 of a show about women being good at their jobs in a hospital. And they were like, let's bring in a doctor who you see her areolas before you see her face. And she's just like fucking people in closets all the time. That'd be, and then she like can't read. And I was like, absolutely. I have Lady Percy from Henry VIII, if you'd like to see that. And they're like, no, just the areolas would be great. but I would, you know, try and Trojan horse weird choices into those kind of bimbo scenes, and slowly they started writing towards the weirder side of me and less the nipple side.
that is so interesting.
Yeah.
And I read this quote about when you started GLOW, that you reminded the showrunners that you have, quote, crazy bees in you,
yeah.
and you were almost reminding them of what you were capable of.
Mm-hmm. I was nervous that, because, you know, on paper, in, like, the character blurb for Debbie, it was like, you know, it kind of was like, the alpha in the friendship and soap star and kind of like, you know, Ruth, you really don't have it all together, and I do. And that, not in the script, but there was an element where I was like, oh, God, I just want to make sure it's not like the person who is like has it all together. I also want to be a mess. And I just wanted to make sure that, like, you know, she has rage and sadness in her as well. And, you know, Liz and Carly are so brilliant. And every single woman of the 15 of us has crazy bees inside them in a different way.
Right.
Like, we have it handled. Don't worry about it.
How did it put all the other sets you've been on in your TV career
yeah.
into perspective in terms of being listened to?
Right. Like,
how much did it put a new filter on your other TV experiences?
Yeah, it just, there's a level of safety and feeling like you're valued when you arrive to work that morning instead of having to earn it. Like, I wasted so many takes on sets of Yore auditioning for the job I already had.
What do you mean?
I mean, like, I guess when you are a lady, your call is way earlier because you have more hair and makeup than everybody else, than the boys. So you've gone through 2 hours of like, and like, and you're kind of like presented like this, and you kind of waddle into set like that, and you stand on, you know, your stilettos that are, you know, advertising your calves to be sold for goats later. And there's sort of this sense, you know, in theater school, you're like in your pajamas, like, let's try this, let's do this, feeling so free. And it's the opposite of this feeling where you're like, oh, I'm here for a different purpose than I thought I was. When I was rehearsing this stuff in my room last night, I was like, what about this idea and this idea? And I'll do this and like make this weird choice I don't know. I'll see what happens. And then when you're like this, the last thing you're feeling is like safe and free, especially when like, you know, like a producer who looks like Santa's heroin addict brother is like, hey, here's a meaty paw in the small of your back. Like, here's a loud sentence that I'm going to pass as a joke. And you have to be like, oh, it's very funny. And then it's your job to be creative. And you're like, well, I kind of feel like not creative. In fact, I feel like I'm still auditioning. Why? Okay, I'll just do three takes where they know that I can form sentences, and then the fourth take will be like, here's my weird idea that I had in my bedroom. Never mind, never mind. You can just use the other takes. I can't even explain it. And it's not there with GLOW at all. It's like, do your weirdest idea, take one, and then go crazy from there. Because you're not thinking about sucking it in and being acceptably small in personality. And
yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, that's – it would almost – I would think it would take a minute to get acclimated to that new climate in terms
right.
of – like you said, women are accustomed to being a character in someone else's story
mm-hmm.
in the history of storytelling on television and
yes.
film for the
yeah.
most part. And I would think it would take a minute to claim ownership of the rights you now have.
Yeah.
Like, did that require a shift in
yes.
thinking?
Yeah. What's so interesting about this whole time for me personally is, like, in the stuff we're talking about of organized alpha women versus, you know, kind of more nervous, sideline bug people, beta women, I at first was like, oh, gosh, this revolution is only for one kind of woman.
Oh, right.
I don't feel
only
brave enough.
Only for the alpha woman.
Right. I don't feel brave enough, or I don't have my papers in order to be like, hey, here's who I fucking am. Listen to me. I'm in the room. Like, my identity is based on being like, can I get me in the room? Never mind. And so where's my place in that in terms of, like, I guess I realized how much of a male gaze representative was installed in my brain at the door for so many, like, outgoing things. You know, there were so many things that I still have to sort of unteach myself. You know, some of it is my own shame, and some of it is just, like, patriarchy bullshit that's just in my head from being told that that's what's valuable about me. Like, I feel like I'm at a race right now with myself, like aesthetically right now. Like, this is the best it's ever going to be. So let's get to a place where we love ourselves. So when the things that the patriarchy has told me are valuable about myself start to leave and fade and wrinkle beautifully – that I'm in a place where I can be like, oh, I don't think that anymore about myself.
Well, I'll tell you, it. You know, when you describe the producer with the paw on your back and...
Yeah.
It makes me feel like if you get underestimated enough on a regular basis, it's hard mm-hmm. not to sort of fall into an acceptance of that underestimation.
Yeah, it's so hard. It's so hard not to believe the things that the business tells you are valuable about yourself. Especially when you're in a kind of quest mode of like, who am I? What am I? I wonder. I'm going to look for the answer. And someone's like, I've got the answer. It's your tits. Like, or I've got like, you're like, is that the answer? Okay. Huh.
Well, 10 people said it was the answer this week. Maybe they're onto
exactly,
something.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's
difficult. But, you know, I guess I realized like, you know, if North Korea's coming, let's get this show on the road in terms of self-worth.
I mean, it makes me crazy to think about my own kids
yeah.
and their transition from mm-hmm. this artistic, fantastic, imagination-filled life, and then it goes to, oh, the real world where you're looked at this way.
Yeah.
There's all the times that probably in your head you're thinking, oh, I have so much more to offer mm-hmm. to this situation
mm-hmm.
and you're not even open to it.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like for girls it can often be like either your journey is from seeking the answer in other people to realizing the answer is within. I value the part of me also that's like searching and trusting and question asking. But I guess I have also learned to have like border patrol a little bit in terms of like, well, that answer is wrong. I mean, talking about like self-loathing, I feel like it's only when someone insults me or makes me feel very small that I'm like, oh, no, you're wrong. Like when someone compliments me, I'm like, no, they don't. No, I'm terrible. They don't even know the truth. And when someone insults me, like if you get audition feedback, like if someone's like, you're so beautiful inside, I'm like, no, disgusting. But if I get audition feedback where they're like, they want to go prettier, I'm like, fuck you. I know that I'm not ugly. Like it's kind of the opposite where when someone makes you feel like a gargoyle, you're like, I'm a flower. And when someone's like, you're a flower, you're like, I'm trash.
It's complicated.
Yes.
So how did wrestling have an effect on the beta person versus the alpha person? Or how did wrestling have a benefit to you outside of the benefits it was doing for the show?
I mean, just using my body in functional ways. It was the first time I'd ever done that. Like exercise when I was in my 20s and an actress, it was really just for the beach. It was like, okay, I have to be in my underwear in this scene. Let's work out the muscles that are like ding, ding, ding. And like in exercise classes where a woman's like, let's work out that pie, you guys. No man's ever going to love you unless you get rid of this. And it was sort of like very like male gaze Kesha car accident classes with like purple lighting and women looking at their bodies in the mirror being like smaller, smaller, holding, lifting like 2 pound weights. And wrestling was the first time where it was like, use your knees, the things that have been walking you around the world for 31 years that you don't even think about, that you completely take for granted. Use your knees to bend and lift this human and throw them. Like, use the biggest parts of your muscle groups and, like, your booty and your thighs and your core to throw her. And it was so the opposite of anything I'd ever done before, and it felt like it was like the craziest, like, first time I did it.
Right.
It felt like the craziest drug ever. The adrenaline is amazing. My high school theater director told me that I was a good actor from the neck up and from the neck down. I was just scared Betty. And he was not wrong. Like, this, my body was always kind of like, and because of wrestling, I feel like I'm Debbie from head to toenail.
And does that change your personality out in the world at all?
It totally does. I feel a combination of this job and the election, I just feel like one of the steel doors has been opened of like, okay, here's the parts that aren't worth censoring and killing in yourself. Like, those parts are needed.
So after doing GLOW, what won't you do anymore?
You can tell when you're an actress entering a new job, when there's a man on set who you're like, I know exactly the dynamic he wants to have on this job with me. And it's like he wants you to give him, like, vodka soda blowjob eyes by Crafty and have like a sexy dynamic to make the job funner for him, to be like, good morning. Suddenly that it's fun for 1 second and then you feel horrible and scared and weird. And it happens on every job, basically. And I'm just not going to do it anymore. That makes me come off as cold sometimes when, like, I'll start a relationship with a male on a new job being like, good morning, just to let them know, like, it's not ever going to be, like, spicy between us. Because also what happens with that is then I feel like, even when I'm not, like, they, like their hand is on your back a little too long, the hugs are too long, or they treat the getting to know you process like your traits and stories about your life are like sexy little sound bites or something. Like, you're not a real person. And that's how men write women, too. Like, their pain are like sexy little montages instead of like, no, this really happened to this person. I try to change the way men think about me or actresses because it looks like they're not going to do it on their own. I used to be too scared to be like, no, just good morning. I'd be like, oh, I don't want to get fired. I just want this job to end. Yes, good morning. Now I feel gross. Oh, God, now he's looking at me weird all day. Oh, my God, it's my coverage for this scene. He's still looking at me. Oh, I didn't do any of my ideas that I planned because I feel uncomfortable about this dude. Well, now I didn't get to do any of the stuff I love. Like, it just is like a wasted – it's a very, very, very common problem. And
I've talked about it. You're saying this is pretty much on every job.
Yeah, yeah. I've talked about it with many actress girlfriends where this happens – all the time.
It seems like what GLOW has given you an opportunity to see is that you have sort of ownership rights as not only in those situations, but also in the kind of things that it's okay to ask for.
Yes. Like,
I want another take. I want to do it this way.
Yes,
I feel strongly about it.
I want to be brave enough to create the environment where I can have the less brave parts of myself come out and be creative and show their ideas and show their bug notes. You know, usually I would have the bug notes person and be like, can I have another take? And it doesn't need to be that person. It can be a person who's braver and calmer and knows that they earned their spot here. You already have the job. You don't need to make sure the sound guy doesn't think you're an alpha bitch. He doesn't think that. He's not thinking. He's looking at his phone. No one cares.
Well, I think what you're describing is that, you know, that the path that you've taken is equal parts, you know, having to discover yourself and, and learn which dark parts need to stay and learn which parts that are shameful and not helping you need to be vanquished in the case of some of these personalities in your head.
Yes.
And what having an opposite experience on GLOW has made you realize about the kind of artist you can be if you face those parts of yourself and also if you put the world into perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's
beautiful to hear you talk about it that way.
Thank you.
And I loved talking to you.
Oh, I love talking to you.
Yeah. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks.
Hey, folks, that's our show for this time. Thanks for tuning in. And gosh, as we leave on our little summer break, I have to say that that conversation for me epitomizes what off-camera can be, a place where artists can tell the truth about their experiences and their path. In the case of Betty, I was so inspired by her willingness to share those deep insecurities, because not only does it make her more human, but it makes me more able to accept my own insecurities and my own fears about this business. So I hope you all got as much out of that as I did. And I'm sure I don't have to tell you, but go watch Betty's performance in GLOW. There are 2 seasons available on Netflix, and it is an entertaining and enlightening show. And you're just going to fall in love with Betty. So thanks for listening. We are taking a short summer break, but we will be back on August 9th with all new episodes coming to you weekly. So you ask, what am I going to do with my summer without off camera? Well, now's the perfect time to catch up on any episodes that you have missed or to re-listen to some of your favorites. If you go to offcamera.com, we have an archive of over 150 episodes that you can listen to or watch or read in our multi-format off-camera world. If you haven't tried the television show, that's an amazing in-depth experience into what off-camera really is. So go to offcamera.com, check out the monthly subscription, and you can have access to all of our episodes in glorious HD black and white to watch on any device, anytime, as many times as you'd like, all for only $4.99 a month. It's a great way to catch up with the show and support the show and find out what we're doing here each week. So enjoy your summer, take off camera with you, and if you happen to be on social media, tell the world about us. We are Off Camera Show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And I am Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. And if you're looking for that perfect gift or you just want to treat yourself, you can go to offcamera.com, go to our store, and pick up one of our off-camera magazines or our off-camera coffee table book entitled Off Camera, The Portraits. In it, you'll find over 275 pages of exclusive photographs of every artist that has appeared on the show. It makes a great addition to your coffee table, and it's a great way to support Off Camera. And it's a great book to flip through with a summer cocktail in your hand and no plans for your day. And lastly, if you do enjoy this podcast every week, do us a favor, go to the iTunes store and take a minute to give us a rating and maybe comment about the show. That helps the computer robot algorithm help more people to find our show. So take a minute, give us a 5-star rating, and that would really help us out. That would be your summer gift to us. Thank you again. And lastly, before we go, I want to thank everybody that works on this show that helps us make the show a reality. Couldn't do it without all these hardworking people. If you see them on the street, give them a hug, buy them lunch, or just tell them they're doing a good job. Our producer, Crawford Shippey, our visual specialist, Michaela Galvin, our editor, Nathan Shields, our studio manager, Sasha Snow, our transcriptionist, Kara Johnson, and our janitor / fungus identifier, Matthew Davidson. That's all for now, folks. See you in a few weeks. Enjoy your summer.